Frances Ellen Watkins Harper was best known as a poet. She was the most famous Black poet in America before Paul Laurence Dunbar. And today we don't know any of her poetry, but this was probably her most famous, called Bury Me Not in a Land of Slaves. Make me a grave where'er you will, in a lowly plain or a lofty hill. Make it among earth's humblest graves, but not in a land where men are slaves. I could not rest if around my grave I heard the steps of a trembling slave. His shadow above my silent tomb would make it a place of fearful gloom. I could not rest if I heard the tread of a coffle gang go to the shambles led, and the mother's shriek of wild despair rise like a curse on the trembling air. I could not sleep if I saw the lash drinking her blood at each fearful gash, and I saw her babes torn from her breast like trembling doves from their parent nest. I'd shudder and start if I heard the bay of bloodhounds seizing their human prey, and I heard the captive plead in vain as they bound afresh his galling chain. If I saw young girls from their mother's arms bartered and sold for their youthful charms, my eye would flash with a mournful flame, my death-pale cheek grow red with shame. I would sleep, dear friends, where bloated might can rob no man of his dearest right. My rest shall be calm in any grave where none can call his brother a slave. I ask no monument, proud and high, to arrest the gaze of the passers-by. All that my yearning spirit craves is bury me not in a land of slaves. If there's anybody who has heard of Frances Harper before seeing something about this presentation, to raise your hands. Well, I never had either, so. Alice, our religious exploration director, knew a little bit about her. And my presentation today on Frances Harper relates to our second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. I have been reading about and talking about women in UU history for almost 30 years now. And I had a whole range, some very early figures like Abigail Adams or Margaret Fuller, who was in the early 1800s. I talked in 2020 about a woman who was at the actual signing of the 19th Amendment. There were women who were upper class, lower class, from different parts of the country. But one thing they all had in common was that they were all white. Now, this was not surprising because Unitarians and Universalists at the time, like today, were overwhelmingly a white congregation. But I was so surprised to find out that one of our most influential forebears was hiding in plain sight. And I didn't even recognize her the first two times she came to my attention. So I'm going to show some slides for part of my presentation. In 2020, I did a presentation at Sauk City about how suffragists were portrayed in popular novels and stories in the 50 years before the vote. And I have gotten more ideas from browsing the Frugal Muse. I found this odd little book, Feminist Activism in American Fiction, 1870 to 1920, Romancing the Vote. I'm sure it's a book that's not in print. It's somewhat academic, but I found it interesting and got a talk out of it. There was one non-white writer in here, and that was Frances Harper. I'd never heard about her, but I read that she was very popular. She was famous as a poet, essayist, and speaker against slavery and for women's rights. And then this year, I did a different talk. Just a minute here. There we go. For Sauk City about the history of Black women and the fight for the vote. This is a wonderful new book, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All, or the short title is A Vanguard by Dr. Martha S. Jones. And Frances Harper was covered at length here for her political and social activism. But it was only right before I gave the talk based on this book that I glanced through the UU World magazine and I saw the name of Frances Ellen Watkins Harper listed with other Unitarian heroes of civil rights. I think it might have been in the children's section. I said, what? I've never heard her mentioned in UU history, including the many RE curricula I used to teach. Her picture wasn't featured in the poster of famous UUs that was on our church wall by the water fountain. I used to look at that for ideas. I'm sure I would have noticed her. Well, when I read about her in the two books I just mentioned, I made what might be a racist assumption. I assumed she must have been active in a Baptist or African Methodist Episcopal, AME church. Most Black women drew their strength and their leadership training from the Black church. And in fact, it was brilliant. A bunch of Black men gathering after the Civil War would have been an invitation for vigilantes, but a bunch of Black ladies dressed up and meeting at church was perfectly okay. However, they were using this to build their power. Well, Harper did start out in the AME church, but she switched to Unitarian as an adult because the Unitarians reflected her views on social issues and apparently on religious issues as well. When Susan B. Anthony wrote her History of Women's Suffrage, she wrote the history of the white women's movement. Frances Harper didn't write a memoir or autobiography. She didn't leave a lot of journals. She spoke very little about her personal life. There is no full-length biography of Harper. I was very excited to find that there was a book that came out at the end of last year. It's apparently a series on Black lives. As it turned out, there's one extended chapter on her life, and the rest are reviews of her novels and other writings, which is also interesting, but there's definitely room for someone to write an extended biography of her life. And I was also interested, this summer, my daughter sent me for my birthday this charming book, Why She Wrote, A Graphic History of the Lives, Inspiration, and Influence Behind the Pens of Classic Women Writers. And what it has is a page about the writer, say Jane Austen, and then it's got a sort of comic strip or graphic novel depiction of a point in their life where they decided to become a writer and why. As I was looking through it, I thought, this is so great. I wish there was something for Frances Harper. And lo and behold, she was in there. So I think she's being rediscovered. Another thing is, if any of you watched the Netflix series, The Chair, about academia, which I found very entertaining, there's a young Black woman up and coming, and they mention at one point, oh, didn't you write that paper or about Frances Ellen Watkins Harper? So maybe she's being rediscovered. Well, when I started looking myself, I did find several UU speakers online giving sermons on Frances Harper, including one from the First Unitarian Church in Philadelphia, where Harper was a regular attendee, and she's actually buried in that graveyard. Generally, when these ministers talked about her, they listed her accomplishments, but they rarely got into the challenges she was up against. She was forced to deal with what we today call intersectionality, being disadvantaged both by race and by gender. Harper was much more than a writer. She traveled around the country and spoke at all sorts of venues up to 4 times a day. Remember, this was in the age of trains and horse-drawn vehicles, and as a Black woman, she regularly suffered indignities that reinforced her dedication to the struggle for equality. Frances Ellen Watkins was born in 1825 in Baltimore, and here's a picture of what Baltimore might have looked like approximately that time. There's so little research into her that we don't know the names of her parents. Now, there is a reason for this. They both died when Frances was 3, and she went to live with her uncle and aunt, William and Henrietta Watkins. This turned out to be a good thing. This family valued education. They were apparently quite nurturing to Frances, and they encouraged her to read from their extensive library. Her uncle William was a well-known abolitionist and public speaker. William Lloyd Garrison and other activists visited the home frequently. In some of my earlier talks, I explained that women who got a so-called boys' education, such as Margaret Fuller, disproved the idea that women were inferior. In the same way, Frances Watkins Harper's education showed that There was no barrier to Black academic achievement as long as they had the resources. Although Frances's home was rich in education, money was lacking. She went to work as a teenager as a servant for a white family. Fortunately, this family also had a library and encouraged Frances to use it during her break times. Later, she became the first woman hired as a faculty member at Union Seminary, which was to become Wilberforce University in Ohio, a traditionally Black college. Although, in spite of her education, the subject she was hired to teach was sewing. In Maryland, Frances would have known a society that juxtaposed free and enslaved Black people, white abolitionists, and white people who used slave labor. The passage of the Fugitive Slave Law in 1850 enhanced the risk that Frances and other free people could be kidnapped and sold into the South. And of course, it's the basis of the true story, 12 Years a Slave. Through the abolitionist circles in her family, Frances became familiar not only with national leaders, but with women essayists and poets. She read The Liberator, a journal published by William Lloyd Garrison, and The North Star, published by Frederick Douglass. These newspapers and others were looking for works from Black writers. So after writing for some of these papers, Frances published a book of poetry, Forest Leaves, in 1845, and poems on miscellaneous subjects in 1854. This second book was reprinted 5 times and sold over 10,000 copies. For contrast, Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass sold fewer than 100 copies when it was first published. Now, as you could tell, her verse was very approachable, something that people could memorize, which was very desirable at the time. But it also addressed important subjects. In 1850, Frances published the first short story by an African-American woman, The Two Offers. By the late 1850s, Frances was a popular speaker who was able to support herself by sales of her books. That was very rare for white or Black women. She was extremely active with Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad and donated much of her money there. In 1852, Frances left her position at Union Seminary and moved to Pennsylvania, where she lived with William and Letitia Still, key members of the local abolitionist movement. So interestingly, you can find a picture today of William Still, but not of his wife, Letitia. It may seem quite normal to us that Harper became a public speaker, but there was still fierce opposition to women speaking in public on serious topics, let alone Black women. The audiences, of course, were overwhelmingly white. According to reports from the time, Frances was a charismatic and engaging speaker and could speak well off the cuff. Her success was always dedicated to the movement, not to advancement for herself. After the publication of 12 Years a Slave in 1853, Frances advocated for the free labor boycott. The idea was that Northerners would refuse to buy goods made by slave labor. Not everyone approved of her speaking or of the boycott. So in the book I mentioned, Vanguard, Dr. Martha S. Jones says, appearing on an anti-slavery stage was not easy. Harper generated controversy as audience members debated whether she, with all her talent and refinement, really was a woman equal to her white counterparts. Harper was parodied by Southern and anti-abolitionist journalists. One dubbed her a mulatto girl, which was an insult, and said she argues that the surest and quickest way of placing the colored race in the position to live without labor is for the white folks to abandon the use of sugar and cotton and other products of slave labor. Like all those poor people would be unemployed if this were to succeed. Like other Black women, Frances suffered daily indignities on streetcars, trains, and on the roads, and this was in the North. So here's an example of the horse-drawn streetcars of the time. In 1858, Harper wrote, "The other day, the conductor came to me and wanted me to go out on the platform. Now, was that not brave and noble? That is, she should ride outside. As a matter of course, I did not." So this was a good 100 years before Rosa Parks. "I did not move, but kept the same seat. When I was about to leave, He refused my money, and I threw it down on the car floor and got out after I had ridden as far as I wished. Such impudence. She also wrote about being accosted out on the roads. On the Carlisle Road, I was interrupted and insulted several times. Two men came after me in one day. At a meeting in Cool Spring, Ohio, a newspaper reported, an attempt was made to break up by rowdy violence one of Miss Watkins' meetings. In this case, the offenders were arrested and Harper sued. And Martha Jones says, rather than sanctuaries, courtrooms permitted the insults to her dignity to continue. The court required Harper to repeat her lecture for the jury so that it might determine the character of the meeting. Harper did win the case and the right to speak. But as we know, such a judgment had little effect on rowdies throughout the territory. It's hard to imagine the stressful effects of these almost daily macro aggressions on Frances Harper. And yet she was undeterred. In the 1850s, Frances spoke regularly in Maine, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Ohio, as far west as Kansas and Nebraska. She also toured Canada, all while continuing to write. Frances was highly affected by the story of Margaret Garner, an escapee from slavery who killed her own daughter rather than allow her to be returned to slavery. This happened in Ohio. And Frances decried the fact that no organization or church in that state stepped forward to protect that mother and child. In the lead up to the Civil War, Frances was both a public and a private supporter of John Brown and his mission to lead a slave rebellion. And here's a picture from John Brown's raid. After Brown's arrest, Frances corresponded with Brown's wife and offered money and help. In 1860, at the advanced age for that era of 35, Frances Watkins married Fenton Harper. He was a widower with three children, and they soon added a daughter. They were able to purchase a farm in Ohio with the proceeds from Frances's poetry. Frances's training as a servant was useful in running the household, but she also continued her public speaking. She wrote a detailed objection to President Lincoln's plan to send freed slaves to Canada, Africa, and other destinations. That was an early idea of Lincoln's. But after just 4 years of marriage, Fenton died, and we do have a picture of his grave. However, he left many debts. As a woman, Frances was unable to get any kind of loan against the property or her projected income. So everything that she owned, everything from the home, most of which had been paid for by her, was repossessed, except for one hand mirror. Now, most biographical articles just state that after her husband died, Frances moved away, but they give no hint of this tragedy based on the inequality of property and financial rights. And in this case, being a white woman probably would not have helped her either. Well, this experience intensified her drive for full rights for women. Soon after the Civil War ended, Frances began to travel in the South. She lectured and taught in multiple states, often there to audiences of Black women. Sometimes she stayed with former slaves. She publicized some issues that we rarely hear about in studying the period. I had not thought of this, but there were many refugees with no homes. People who were no longer enslaved, of course, did not get the property they had been promised. Also, the problem of reunifying families was immense. Many mothers and children had been separated when the children were infants or toddlers. How were they even going to recognize each other? Their names could have been changed multiple times by plantation owners, and they could have been resold to other parts of the South. At the same time, Frances retained her passion for women's rights. Utz McKnight states, in 1866, Frances Harper gave a speech at the 11th National Women's Rights Convention in New York. This speech represented her coming into national prominence for the post-war activist push for women's rights, work that would occupy her for the major part of the next few decades. And this is where she gave the speech talking about how we are all bound up together. Race, along with women's suffrage, of course, remained a central concern for her vision. And in that speech, she said, "I do not believe that giving the woman the ballot is immediately going to cure all the ills of life. I do not believe that white women are dewdrops just exhaled from the skies. I think that, like men, they may be divided into three classes, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. You white women speak here of rights. I speak of wrongs. Let me go tomorrow morning and take my seat in one of your streetcars, and the conductor will put up his hand and stop the car rather than let me ride. One day I took my seat in a car and the conductor came to me and told me to take another seat. I just screamed murder. The man said if I was black, I ought to behave myself. I knew that if he was white, he was not behaving himself." Harper pointed out that when these incidents happened, white women never once stepped forward to object or to support a black woman. And this was in northern cities such as Philadelphia and New York. Now, at this convention, Harper was the only black woman to speak on the platform with Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucretia Mott. But the leadership respected her enough to appoint her to the Finance Committee, which raised funds for the cause of suffrage. And here's her picture again. 3 years later, Harper published the poetry book, Moses, A Story of the Nile. Throughout her career, she referred to the story of Moses as an analogy to the freeing of American slaves. And we see that in a number of spirituals as well. The same year, 1869, her first novel, Minnie's Sacrifice, was published as a serial in a magazine called Christian Recorder. Both works express a yearning for and a demand for racial and gender equality. These years of constant travel and speaking took a toll on Frances' health. In 1871, at the age of 46, she settled in Philadelphia. She worked as assistant superintendent of the YMCA, bought a house for herself and her daughter, and continued to write. And then I'm going to go off of there to tell you a little bit more. Here's an excerpt from the UU biography site about her religious engagement and how she got involved with Unitarians. Although busy as a writer and active in public life, Harper continued to engage personally in social concerns at the local level. She worked with a number of churches in the Black community in North Philadelphia near her home, which is interesting because when I lived in Philadelphia in the 1960s, North Philadelphia was a Black community, and I'm sure it's still so today. She worked at feeding the poor, preventing juvenile delinquency, and teaching Sunday school at the Mother Bethel AME Church. Both Unitarians and the AME Church have claimed Harper as a member. She was reluctant to choose between the two. AME was the church she has been raised in. It was family and home to her, and she always remembered where she came from and what her people had been through. Her reasons for joining the Unitarian Church may have been partly political, although she had had personal and professional contacts in both Black and white communities. Ever since her first book of poems was published, many doors remained closed to her. In a society where color lines were clearly drawn, a Unitarian church provided a rare opportunity for the races to meet. The Unitarians she knew could help to advance the causes she supported in places she could never go. And the UU site also says that Harper's Christology was Unitarian. Christ was not a distant God to her, but a role model for the kind of exalted existence that all human beings could attain. Now, at the same time as her writing and community work, Harper was involved from the 1870s into the 1900s in the Association for the Advancement of Women, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the Universal Peace Union, the American Women's Suffrage Association, the International Council of Women, the National Council of Women, and the Women's Congress. All of these organizations were almost exclusively run by white women and consisted of white women, and she was often the only Black leader. But when the chance arose, she was also a leader in her own community. She was a founding member of the National Association of Colored Women, which was to become a large and influential association of women's clubs. She worked alongside Ida B. Wells against lynching. While living in Philadelphia, Harper published several more books of poems and three novels. The The most famous and the only one generally known at all is Iola Leroy, which Harper wrote when she was 67 years old. Because of Harper's fame as a poet, the novel sold well and received positive reviews. This book is one of the rare contemporary records of the lives of enslaved people toward the end of the Civil War and just after. And I'll just tell you a little bit about it. The novel starts with a Black man returning from town. Others asked him if the butter was fresh today. This was a code for whether the Yankees were winning. So from the beginning, the Black characters are shown as intelligent and resourceful. We also learn of a Black laundress who passed information to the Union Army by the way she hung out the laundry. Early in the book, the Yankees do take over the plantation, and many of the Black men choose to join Black regiments fighting on the Union side. This may be the only account of that experience from a Black point of view. Of course, Frances Harper wasn't there, but soon after the war, she spent years in the South talking to those people who had been there. Now, the story then shifts to the teenage Iola Leroy. She grew up in the South in a white household. She's blonde and blue-eyed. She and her brother are sent north for their education. At her boarding school, Lydia differs with the Northern abolitionist girls. In a chapter titled Schoolgirl Notions, she insists, "Slavery can't be wrong, for my father is a slaveholder, and my mother is as good to our servants as she can be. Slaves do not want their freedom. Slavery is not wrong if you treat them well." But Iola's family contains a terrible secret. Her mother had some Black blood, but the parents never told Iola or her brother Robert about it. When Iola's father dies, the relative who inherits claims that the marriage of Iola's parents was invalid because it was mixed race. Worse, Iola, Robert, and their mother are now sent into slavery. Iola finds this out only after she has traveled back to the South, too late to see her dying father. She warns Robert not to come back, and he becomes a Union officer. Meanwhile, Iola admits, "I used to say that slavery was right. I didn't know what I was talking about." Interestingly, we don't hear more about the fact that her father, despite marrying a woman he knew was mixed race, kept slaves. Frances Harper, interestingly, skips over the actual time of Iola's slavery so that we see her next as a nurse helping the Union troops after they have freed her area. Harper only makes reference to the time in this way. "I was sold from state to state as an article of merchandise. I had outrages heaped on me, which might well crimson the cheek of honest womanhood with shame. I have heard men talk glibly of the degradation of the Negro, but there is a vast difference between abasement of condition and degradation of character. I was abased, but the men who trampled on me were the degraded ones." Elsewhere, she talked about women who were accused of tainting the race, stating that it is the men who are doing the tainting. Some of Harper's points ring true today. After the war, Iola becomes a teacher for Black children, which is what Frances Harper also did for a while. She writes about how a white man comes to the school and says, "He essayed to talk to them on the achievements of the white race, such as building steamboats and carrying on businesses. Finally, he asked how they did it. 'They've got money,' chorused the children. 'But how did they get it?' 'They took it from us,' chimed the youngsters." Iola smiled, and the gentleman was nonplussed, but he could not deny that one of the powers of knowledge is the power of the strong to oppress the weak. Now, you could imagine the same conversation taking place today, or perhaps you have heard that, as when conservative TV and radio figures announced that America was built by white people. A white doctor, Dr. Gresham, admires Iola, and even when he learns of her ancestry, he wants to marry her, assuring her she can pass as white in the North. She declines, feeling loyalty to her people and also questioning how her suitor will feel if they have a dark-skinned child. Against great odds, Iola and Robert find their mother. So there's a lot in this book about the issue of families getting reunited and how important that was to the Black community. But when they move north, all is not sweetness and light. They can get jobs and rent homes based on their appearance, but as soon as the employer or landlord learns of their heritage, they are refused entry or thrown out. Iola is such a feminist that she declares, Every woman ought to know how to earn her own living. She takes a job as a saleswoman in a white company, but she is outed when a coworker asks what church she attends. Iola admits where she goes and that she goes there to be with her own people. Well, Harper died on February 22, 1911, 9 years before women gained the right to vote. Her funeral service was held at the Unitarian Church in Philadelphia. Although an extremely popular writer and during her lifetime, Harper was not acclaimed by literary critics. And shortly after, Harper's style was dismissed as sentimental. Her message held in suspicion by some Black male critics because her mixed race protagonists were not sufficiently Black. There's been a fair amount of discussion about whether Harper made her heroine fair and blonde out of colorism. I think it was for two reasons. One was to make it easier for white readers to empathize with Iola, and another is to show how ridiculously arbitrary any notion of race really is. Utz McKnight sees larger causes at work in the falloff of respect for Harper. He says the need to minimize the importance of Black women in the major women's rights organizations led to the removal or marginalization of the contributions of Frances Harper. Frances Harper did not fit the model of the pathetic Black person in need of succor and charity from white benefactors. And she had not been a slave who escaped. Her work was too radical, too invasive of social norms. Her success belied all the stereotypes of Black inferiority that were being strengthened in the Jim Crow era. During the 20th century, her reputation waned further and the best of her poetry languished unread. Harper's gravestone fell over and was covered by grass. In recent decades, however, Black women and feminists in general have resurrected Harper's legacy. In 1992, African-American Unitarian Universalists honored her and commemorated the 100th anniversary of Iola Leroy by installing a new headstone. In the excavation, the old headstone was uncovered, forgotten, but still enduring, kind of a symbol for us. Harper's call for full human development, Black and white, male and female, also endures, as urgent and vital during these decades, following the civil rights movement and women's liberation, as it was during Reconstruction and its aftermath. So we do have a little time for some comments or questions. Yes, this was common for there to be these traveling speakers on all kinds of subjects, and that was entertainment. People did not have other entertainment options. There were also things like Chautauquas where you'd have whole groups of speakers. And then just to mention that when you're talking about literary society, for all of these women, there was basically no higher education. Many of them did not even have access to high school educations officially. They were largely self-taught. They would read and discuss and form their own groups. An early college that admitted women was Oberlin, but then there were very few opportunities like that. I know there are quite a few essays because she wrote in both kinds of papers, and also that it's something because someone like Frederick Douglass was famous, that some of his things were preserved, and her love for poetry and essays were available to others. And she was famous at the time as a poet, that helped. I keep wondering who else there is out there, because since she was discovered out of nowhere by me, I mean by all of us, that there must be much more. But you're right, there's such a wealth that's been lost because that wasn't considered of any interest. And even things that people wanted to keep, the newspapers would be just in one place and there'd be a fire, or you know, all kinds of things were destroyed. Things were not kept in any kind of archival manner. It's a really interesting challenge. So you're talking. Harriet Tubman was, of course, known for all her work with the Underground Railroad and so on. So she was famous in other circles that might have something to do with it. Certainly, there are white sentimental authors who like Harriet Beecher Stowe. Uncle Tom's Cabin is very sentimental. That's who you were thinking of. So yes, Harriet Beecher Stowe was a white woman. Yes, that was very, and certainly, I'm sure she was also dismissed as sentimental by literary critics and so on, but the social aspect, her influence was so great, right? Lincoln said, "Oh, I wanted to meet the woman who started the Civil War," where although Frances Harper did have good sales, it wasn't anywhere near in this level. Some of it had to do with the times. I mean, this was the Romantic period, the Victorian period. People like Charles Dickens were also dismissed as sentimental when it came into the, once we get into the 20th century, there were world wars and people said, all that stuff is old now. And we tend to have these cycles where things are rediscovered. There have been a number of things like that. You're talking about Zora Neale Hurston, who was in the 20th century, but was pretty much forgotten until she was rediscovered by more modern writers. So we keep having these cycles of it. Yeah, and these things were coming from her life. And although, of course, she was not a slave, she had a lot of contact with people who had lived in, lived that. And then her poetry is a bit simplistic, you might say, in form, but so was others of that time, like Whittier or Longfellow or someone. This was a standard form of poetry, except for someone more experimental like Whitman. And it was very well known. So her first poems were more about nature rather than being as socially conscious, and they were about nature and religion. She does have a lot of references to religion. For instance, it mentioned the Moses story, but many other things. That was the popular culture in a sense. Everybody knew the Bible, and that's what you could refer to get people's attention and give them a story to latch onto. I totally agree with that. And she was even blonde. I swear it helps to be blonde to get attention from the media. And then what used to annoy me is I had a coworker who said, "Oh, it's too complicated to follow political issues or something," but she knew every detail about scandals like this and also about who was winning on Survivor. And it depends where you want to put your attention. Did Kathy Converse, did you want to say something before? I'm pretty sure you can find that online. I think it's all in public domain. And I think if you were to just search that, and I don't know if it's officially called Bury Me Not. If you look up Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, that's her most famous, one of her most famous things. But I can also send it on Prairie Views. And I did find you can purchase through Kindle or probably other services complete works of Frances Harper because it's all in public domain. Or you can find them on your computer if you want to sit on the computer and read stuff. I think Iola Leroy I got out from the public library because that's one that's been actually reprinted. I will have a follow-up. I'm preparing for Sauk City for October, a follow-up on additional other novels and poems by her. I feel like, well, we've had multiple presentations on someone like Emerson or Thoreau. We could have an additional presentation on her. Dara, you had something else? All right. Well, yes, we can. Are we ready to wrap up then with the closing words? So this is from Iola Leroy. "Never will I recognize any religion which despises the least of our brethren."
Well, thanks. Thanks you, Robin, for pinch hitting. This wasn't our original plan service either. So.